Hi, Jamel.
Hey, how you doing? I'm doing pretty good.
You're doing well.
Yeah.
Okay. So nice to talk to you. I guess we wanted to start here talking about the sort of big news, also non-news this week, which is that the Republicans in the House, joined by a small number of Democrats, repealed the health care bill.
Right.
There's been some, some sort of back and forth that I've found kind of interesting. When I first wrote about it at Reason, I put the word symbolic in the headline. A lot of my commenters didn't seem to like that. But I think, I actually think the Wall Street Journal had the right idea this morning, which is that it is symbolic in the sense that there's no substantive change. I mean, you don't get anywhere by passing this repeal bill. You don't change the bill at all.
Right.
You don't really, not in any direct, meaningful way, you don't move towards changing the law.
Right.
And so in that sense, it certainly is symbolic. I don't know what I'm curious what you think of this and sort of what you think of the effort.
I mean, I feel basically the same way, or I think basically the same thing. It's all, I mean, it's really just smoke and mirrors from the outset. There aren't the votes for appeal in the Senate. There don't seem to be any Senate Democrats who are willing to, float the idea of repeal. Even if there were, President Obama would veto it. And so this is, I mean, this is a symbolic action. I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, if I were a Tea Party Republican or a conservative Republican, or if I were against a health care bill, I would still appreciate the symbolic action of repealing the health care bill. It shows that the leadership is at least that we share the same priorities. We're just sort of limited by political realities.
I think that is a big part of it, and I think that's one of the best defenses. Is the, and you combine that with the fact that it was a promise,
Right.
and in some ways it's a really easy promise to keep because it is symbolic,
Right.
because it is just a symbolic measure. The other thing I was sort of thinking about though is that it's like a teaser in a movie. Or at the beginning of an hour-long television show, if you ever read books on script writing, for these hour-longs, if you watch any hour-long scripted drama, it always starts with a sort of 4 or 5 minute teaser segment before the
Right.
credits roll, and this is what's supposed to hook the viewer. Now, in a well-scripted show, it sets the plot in motion and actually means something later on. But then you get instances like my favorite one is actually the opening sequence to Lethal Weapon 4, and I don't know if you remember this,
I do.
but it's this great action scene sort of in the middle of LA. You don't really know where it is. They just sort of drop you in the middle. There's some crazy guy in a metal suit with a flamethrower torching a gas station. A lot of stuff blows up. And in the middle of this action scene, they frequently cut away to Danny Glover and Mel Gibson talking about some of the sort of personal family events that come into play later in the story. But overall, the action sequence itself doesn't have anything to do with the rest of the movie. In fact, because they started shooting it before they had a script finished. And so their idea was, hey, let's make Lethal Weapon 4. We've got to come up with something exciting to get it going, and then we can shoot these inserts for, that actually move the plot along later and sort of stick that stuff in later. And I feel like in some ways, this is what the healthcare repeal effort in the House is. It's an explosive teaser to sort of get people's attention and get things moving, and they'll figure out the rest of it as they go along later. And so that's sort of what we've seen here. And there's sort of at least a dramatic, from the perspective of congressional drama. It's understanding that you want to do this. You want to hook people, get people involved at the beginning.
I mean, as it happens, on a substantive level, I don't actually think that there is much hope for repeal at all, ever. Or even like, I mean, if, in 2012, Republicans are able to make a few more gains in the Senate, then you might see more earnest attempts to undermine the bill and through funding, through, attacking specific programs. But I really doubt that there's a, that legislatively Republicans will be able to alter the bill in any significant way.
Certainly not before 2020. well,
right, not before 2012. Like, if President Obama loses re-election and there's, like, Republican majorities in both houses, then they'll have a chance. And frankly, if that happens, I would say go for it. You've earned it. So
let me ask you this. I mean, what do you think of the prospects for taking out specific provisions, perhaps even some major provisions? I think later we want to talk a little bit about that great John Cohn piece on healthcare challenges in the courts. But my understanding is that Republicans are at least interested in going after the mandate.
Yeah.
And going after some of the smaller provisions, particularly some that have, that industry doesn't like, the device tax, like IPAB, things like that. But Republicans, my understanding is that there are a bunch of legislators out there who want to go after the mandate, and regardless of what courts do, might try and take it out. And it seems to me that maybe it's not likely, but it's at least plausible that you could get the votes in the Senate, given that there have been some Senate Democrats, including guys like Ron Wyden, who've said that maybe the mandate isn't the best idea. You have, Howard Dean and those types saying, look, it's just a handout to insurance companies. So there is some liberal wariness about the mandate. Like I said, I don't think it's necessarily likely, but it's not totally implausible.
I mean, it depends. Like, for to go to like smaller programs, right? Community health centers, the small bore stuff that has really gone under the radar. I think there's you can imagine a plausible scenario by which Republicans sort of defund this on the sly, and Senate Democrats, and Democrats just like not wanting to, drag on the fight, or like maybe this is tied to something that they want, go along with it. I think that, that could happen. On the same token, I'm not sure how likely it is, because these small board things are exactly the things that kick in sooner and could build a constituency for support. So for instance, the provision that lets parents keep their 20 somethings on their health insurance. I can't imagine any Republican wanting to repeal that, for the simple reason that it benefits
You certainly wouldn't repeal that by itself, or right, even in a very small package. Republicans wouldn't be interested. I think they've had trouble talking about pre-existing conditions and children's coverage.
Yeah.
For a while, it's been a relatively effective way to trip them up. On the other hand, it strikes me, I don't know how much actual, you said that they might be able to defund some of it on the sly in the Senate. I'm not sure how much they can actually do there. It seems like the best chance they have really is just to gum up the works in HHS and,
yeah,
to a lesser extent at CMS. My understanding is HHS is already, they feel understaffed at least. They feel like they don't have enough people to especially be carrying out the regulation writing and all the research and whatnot that goes along with that. And if you, if you defund that and say you can't spend money on it, then that makes it harder. And then the other thing is oversight. If you, through oversight, my sense is that a lot of oversight activity on healthcare is not even going to be directed at getting answers that Republicans care about, but will instead be intended to waste staff time,
right,
preparing materials, rather than, than actually producing responses that they, this is information we really want. Instead, it's just going to be, how can we waste their time?
And I wouldn't be shocked if, for those same agencies, if they have any, executive branch vacancies, if they have any vacancies that need to be filled through appointment, I wouldn't be shocked to see Republicans just refuse to fill those appointments, especially if there isn't any sort of meaningful filibuster reform or any meaningful confirmations reform, which, the two are related but not the same. It would not surprise me at all to see Republicans just say, man, we're not going to confirm those people. People who would have an impact on the implementation of healthcare. But I wanted to go to the mandate. I could imagine the scenario where this is like totally, this would not happen. But let's say you had some Republicans who did buy the basic idea that there should be more expanded healthcare, health insurance or health coverage. I could imagine someone like Ron Wyden working with one of those Republicans to, get rid of the mandate in exchange for something else that would satisfy the aims of both liberals and conservatives. But since the Republican Party doesn't actually seem interested in universal coverage at all, and seems totally satisfied with the healthcare status quo as it existed before the Affordable Care Act, then, you know, any hope for, any conservative hope for getting rid of the mandate really seems to rest on a court challenge.
I guess I would say that it doesn't strike me that the Republicans are particularly satisfied with the healthcare status quo. I mean, especially certainly the folks who genuinely care about healthcare policy are not. But even like your bog standard backbencher for whom healthcare policy is not the biggest issue or the biggest priority, it doesn't strike me that they're actually satisfied with the status quo. It's just that there's been not very much discussion and certainly very little agreement on the Republican side about how to go about replacement. This has certainly been very frustrating to me as someone who hates both the status quo and not pleased at all with the Affordable Care Act. I don't know if they've given up on replace, but they certainly haven't put much energy toward it because, frankly, it's hard.
I mean, if I to offer like a theory on why that is, and this isn't meant to like disparage anyone, but to say that healthcare policy has been sort of a standard issue or a standard concern within the Democratic Party for basically the entire 20th century, and so by the time whenever a point comes around that like actually implementing healthcare reform or passing it is possible, Democrats have a very deep bench of ideas for doing so. Republicans, by contrast, don't. And it's not, I mean, it may not be because they don't care about insuring people, but because it's just not as high a priority. Go ahead.
Sorry. No, I remember seeing a healthcare presentation by a libertarian policy wonk once who started his presentation by saying, "So I'm a libertarian, which makes me different from Republicans in many ways. One of those ways is that I care about healthcare policy." and I think that at least if you look at Republicans as a political party, rather than conservatives as an ideology or anything, but certainly Republicans as a political party have been far less interested in healthcare and in particular in the details of healthcare policy,
right,
over the past couple of decades. And now they're sort of, they're put in a position where they've got to do something about it, where everybody's going to be talking about it. And the only thing that they can agree to do is to get rid of the policy that we just passed. I'm in favor of getting rid of it. On the other hand, the status quo was terrible. And unsustainable. And this is the big problem, is that Republicans, I think, do need to take step one of getting rid of the Affordable Care Act if they can. On the other hand, that does not put us in a sustainable situation. It doesn't put us in some place where we can afford Medicare and Medicaid long term, where Medicaid is not still, breaking state budgets,
right.
Where Social Security doesn't need some sort of revision, whether it's a minor tweak or whether it's a major overhaul. And Republicans have just been completely unwilling to talk about any, with a few exceptions, I should say there's some exceptions, but particularly Republican leadership, John Boehner, has been the worst about this, totally, totally unwilling to talk about any specifics. I think I saw an item this morning in which he sort of said, "Oh, I don't know, I don't need to think about that. That's why I'm good at delegating." Dear Lord. So anyway, I don't know if that sort of brings us, if there was more you wanted to talk about on the, on the court front. I thought John Cohn had a really interesting long piece in the New Republic looking at the court challenges.
No, yeah, let's just be straightforward. Predictably, I fall on John Cohn's side of these things. And I don't think that, I think the chances of the Supreme Court overturning the individual mandate are slim, not non-existent, but they're slim. But if that were to happen, I would see it as just a straightforward partisan ruling, since doing so especially under the guise of sort of making a distinction between activity and inactivity, as Kahn wrote, would be out of whack with most of court precedent, most of sort of American legal thought. That said, as someone who I guess technically is a constituent of Ken Cuccinelli, I'm really curious to see what he does.
So to me, the interesting thing about the lawsuits has been that they started, that this idea that the mandate was unconstitutional started out as, you know, sort of considered a sort of absurd fringe idea that no one could possibly take seriously. The supporters of the healthcare law, of the overhaul, really just sort of laughed it off and didn't quite go so far as to not prepare at all for the possibility that there was going to be a lawsuit and for defending it, but made some kind of elementary mistakes, the lack of a severability clause. As far as I know, Democrats have said that was, we were rushing the bill through the Senate. It was just a mistake. I've heard some sort of Machiavellian schemes for why it was intentional, but I don't really buy them. And anybody who knows congressional process knows that with these things, you have mistakes.
Right.
Things get rushed through and Senate staff doesn't always, it's a 2000 plus page bill. Very difficult to proofread as a result. And, you know, but sort of as time went on, like over the past 2 years or so, this idea has really grown in currency. I think there's, you know, some truth to the liberal criticism that part of the reason it's grown in currency is that it's been convenient for certain Republicans. On the other hand, it seems to have convinced a number of people who've actually paid attention to the legal issues and amongst the people who are actually concerned with the details, with the constitutional details, rather than just sort of the bog standard Republican legislators for whom healthcare is not a particularly big issue, but who want to go along with their party.
Right.
The chances of this thing went from 1% to 5% to, you know, 15, 20, 25 are, you know, sort of the estimates, people feel like there's a real chance that this thing could actually go down at the Supreme Court. And it strikes me in some ways that this has been the narrative for the healthcare law all along. Democrats thought when they came into Congress, when Obama took the presidency, thought they had a mandate to do something, it would be easy and the public would support them and there would be no questions. Not no questions. I don't want to make it sound like they just thought it was going to be a 2 week process.
But it wouldn't be as acrimonious as it was.
Right. I mean, like there was a lot of feeling, and like this has been sort of the whole thing is that like this sense that a lot of liberals had that this was their time to do it. In many ways it was. On the other hand, it has been much, much tougher than anyone thought, and particularly the support, getting support for this has been a lot tougher than I think liberals estimated. And so now you have this situation where you have more of the public opposed to this specific piece of legislation than support it. You have more than half of the states who have launched constitutional legal challenges, and you have a majority in one chamber that has voted to repeal it. In some ways, that makes the situation look a little better than it is for opponents of the law. I wouldn't say that there's a 51% chance that it's going to get taken down in the next couple of years. On the other hand, that's sort of a remarkable opposition to a brand new entitlement that liberals thought was going to be maybe not a cakewalk, but not absurdly difficult, and something that they thought was they were going to get a lot of support for.
I mean, I don't think it's that remarkable. Just, I mean, I was not one of those liberals who thought it would be a cakewalk. Any cursory history of entitlements in the United States very clearly shows that whenever you try to create one, you're going to run into a lot of opposition, even in the best of circumstances. Medicaid is a really great example. The depth of Republican opposition, sort of the depth and breadth of it, of what, as you said, a lot of states have come out against the bill. I'm most familiar with Virginia, so Cuccinelli has filed lawsuits. the state legislature has passed bills sort of declaring that the individual mandate does not apply to Virginia. The Republican Party, from top down, is basically opposed to new entitlements. And this is a very large, this is the largest new entitlement since the Great Society. So it doesn't really come as a shock to me that you see this sort of like rapid and large reaction to the bill. What I think will come as a shock to opponents of the bill is the extent to which it's incredibly difficult to get rid of entitlements once they've been passed. And that, you know, I'm not sure if opponents, like really fervent opponents, are prepared for the long game here, in the long attempt to undermine it. I think, you know, I will be really interested to see how Tea Party conservatives react, for instance, to the realization that repeal won't go anywhere in Congress. And if the Supreme Court decides to uphold the individual mandate, which again I think is really likely, I'd be curious to see what happens then. Like, how will they react? I should say that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, just sort of as a point with that, you have a bunch of the activist groups working for repeal telling people that there's like there's a way to get this into the Senate and maybe even through. And like, I'm not even sure there's 50 or 51 votes in the Senate, much less 60.
Right, right. I agree. I was going to say something and I just totally lost it.
That's my fault. I apologize.
It happens. I remember. That is, even if the individual mandate is struck down, I don't think that spells the end for healthcare reform. But since I don't think it's going to be struck down, if I were a conservative interested in at least changing the bill to better fit my preferences, I don't see why conservatives don't start trying to make an effort at the state level. The bill does contain provisions for allowing waivers to states to let them go on with their own plans, provided they give similar levels of coverage. And states like Vermont and Oregon are already trying to use that to develop single-payer systems.
Right.
I mean, like, to pivot off something you said, if there are conservatives who are genuinely interested in and who don't like the bill but want a better healthcare system, there's sort of a mechanism within the bill to get halfway to that point, right? Like, you have to live with the bill, but you can twist it to what you prefer.
It's not clear to me how much innovation in terms of what conservatives with, you know, sort of more free market oriented healthcare folks might want would be allowed under the waiver process for the states. So my understanding is that states are only allowed to get waivers if they can promise that coverage levels will not be any different, so that the number of people covered will not be any different, and that the thoroughness of the coverage will not be any different. And a big part of the conservative critique of the liberal healthcare project is that you don't actually is that it's too expensive to provide ultra comprehensive coverage to nearly everyone, and that in fact what you want to do is use insurance to insure against catastrophic expenses and then give people more choices on the day-to-day expenses, on the routine expenses, and on the things that cost less. And so if states want to innovate in that direction, I think it's going to be fairly difficult. The Wyden Brown amendment, I think, would speed up the process of allowing state waivers. Right now, I think that states actually have to wait 3 years as it stands. And so they'd have to sort of set up an exchange and then take it down afterwards, which seems sort of stupid to me. The Wyden Brown amendment, I wish it went much further in allowing states to innovate in a different way. It does seem like a better policy than not, but the flexibility it provides is a flexibility, I think that only really bends one way.
I guess my point is just that, you know, if all the attempts, the court attempts, the legislative attempts to repeal the bill fail, and I think they will, then Republicans will only be left with one option, and that is replace. And I think that even right now, they should be investing more of their energy into finding like actual alternatives or like ways to tweak the bill as to better fit their preferences on the state or federal level.
So I certainly agree. I think I would much prefer to see all of this experimentation done at the state level, and to see folks, you know, to see folks try to do things, you know, try to push healthcare in different directions. I wrote at one point that I would more or less I would take single payer in Vermont and California if, you know, Texas and some other state decided that they wanted to try something different, and were given the opportunity to really to get out of Medicaid in a way that made sense, and to offer, you know, to push high deductible catastrophic plans, and to incentivize those. On the other hand, you know, but as it stands, I'm just not sure that the flexibility exists, even with the waivers, even with Wyden Brown. I mean, you look at what Mitch Daniels has done in Indiana. He has, I believe, he just sent in his third petition to HHS asking for their exchange plans, you know, and for some of what they've done in the state to be allowed to stay, even though it probably won't meet some of the new regulatory muster. And it's not clear that HHS is going to allow him to continue doing what he was doing. Utah's in the same situation. They had a very sort of minimalist exchange. I think it only employed four people. It accepted nearly all insurers, but it provided a place where people could compare and contrast, could see what they were getting. It didn't regulate heavily, but it made for a more transparent market in health insurance. And it's not clear that in Utah they're going to be able to keep that exchange, and that they may have to go towards something that looks a lot more like the Massachusetts exchange. And so these experiments that have been tried may in fact be shut down by the Affordable Care Act. And I think that is one of the problems with the law and its approach to state level experimentation.
Go ahead.
Sorry. I don't know if you want to continue talking about this. I think we've done our 30 minutes already on healthcare.
We're going to try to make a segue into regulation.
So there was this, Obama called for, a review of regulations, within all of his, all the agencies this week.
Was it yesterday?
I think it was 2 days ago. Anyway, so sometime this week. And I think I was a little vexed by it. I'm not sure really what the purpose is, especially since he seems to have exempted, not explicitly, but sort of implicitly exempted, regulations, that come from the healthcare law, the financial overhaul. I'm also hearing that the net neutrality regulations will not really be part of this. So all the new stuff, all the big stuff that actually sort of spurred talk about, excessive regulation kind of seems to be off the table, whether explicitly or not.
I think
what are you hearing? You know, what's the liberal reaction to this?
Well, just to offer a quick response, I think the reason why the healthcare financial reform, the net neutrality stuff isn't on the table is because, as Obama said in the op-ed, he's looking, his administration, their goal is to sort of create new regulations and new methods for, you know, the 21st century. And he includes his stuff that he's had a part in that. It's older regulations and things that aren't part of, you know, the direct Obama agenda, which are problematic or which need to be revised or whatnot. That said, I read the op-ed. I didn't really see what the big deal was. I wasn't really around the blogosphere yesterday or the day before, so I'm not really sure what sort of the liberal blogosphere's response was. But as far as my own friends and people I talk to, there seemed to be, you know, oh, why is Obama caving to business or whatever? But that doesn't seem to be the case at all. You know, just a really straightforward, easy reading is that Obama thinks that there are regulations which are redundant and counterproductive and he wants to get rid of them, which sounds true and totally reasonable to me. I think that there's a tendency among some liberals, at least, to confuse trying to reform capitalism and protect the individual from like corporations or whatever with regulations, and that some liberals look at regulations as an end to themselves, not as a means to a broader end. And for those liberals, I could imagine that they're miffed by this. But for most people, it's sort of, sure, okay, Obama, that sounds good. Don't need to see why you need to declare it in an op-ed, but.
Yeah, it sort of seemed like he was, trying to make nice with business without actually getting rid of any of the things that business is miffed at him for.
And I'm totally okay with
Sure.
that.
He got a sort of tentatively nice response from the chamber, although they also said, that the new rules should be looked at as well. But it just seems like sort of a strange initiative to announce that you're taking that you're going to take action against burdensome regulation in order to get the economy in gear, but then it's not really clear what you're really going to go after and how much difference it's going to make. It seems to go back to what we were talking about earlier, like in many ways a fairly symbolic move.
Right. I was just thinking that this is, I mean, it is a symbolic move from the president. I don't think those are bad things. I would just be more perplexed by,
But it's a symbolic move that doesn't play to your base, right? I mean, when
right.
Republicans repealed the health care bill in the House, it was totally symbolic. On the other hand, Tea Partiers, the most active part of the Republican base, was really happy about this. They really wanted it. I didn't exactly notice, any folks at the American Prospect, for example, clamoring for a review of regulations, over the last 6 months. It didn't come up.
Well, I mean, they may not play to the liberal base, but I mean, of course, the Democratic Party, in terms of demographics, has more moderates and conservatives than does liberals. It's sort of like the eternal problem for liberals that we are oftentimes the loudest and most hardworking members of the Democratic Party, but in terms of numbers, the smallest. And the not the opposite is true, but that's true. That's less true for conservatives and Republicans. Most Republicans, or at least a large plurality of Republicans, are conservatives. And a smaller number are moderates or liberals. And so, they can do these re really conservative symbolic actions and know that they'll play well to most of their party. And the same, if Barack Obama were to do something symbolically liberal, it would play to about 25% of Democrats, maybe 30%. It might alienate the other 70%. But something like this, something symbolic, and nice and pro-business sounding, well, actually probably appeals to a lot of moderate Democrats and conservative Democrats.
Perhaps to the same independence that Republicans are supposedly eyeing with some of the healthcare stuff.
Right.
So it's a different form of the same strategy, except to me it's at least somewhat telling about the mood of the country, about where the political movement is at, that both Republicans and Democrats are attempting to appeal to independence with moves that are sort of with anti-regulation policies. I mean, if you want to take sort of the repealed PPACA as broadly anti-regulatory, that they're both sort of they see that independents are concerned about the role of government in the economy, and that is where both sides are making the play, even if it's a symbolic play largely for both sides.
I mean, yeah, but on the other hand, independents sort of the broad middle of the American public, they sort of go back and forth depending on who's in power. So if I remember correctly, when Reagan entered office, a majority of Americans or a majority of independents said that the United States wasn't doing it, the government wasn't doing enough to intervene in the economy and
Right,
help
no,
U.S. growth.
I don't want to say that independents are always like this, or by any means.
I mean, I just I'm very wary about mood of the country. Argument
Sure.
for this reason that the country tends to be pretty easily swayed, or if not easily swayed, their mood sort of just shifts back and forth depending on who's in power. And so, right now I'm relatively certain that independents would say the government's doing too much, but if in 2012 a conservative Republican were elected with a conservative Republican majority, then within a year I think those same independents would say the government isn't doing enough.
Yeah, no, independence. They're the swing voters, and they swing back and forth, and they both in what they believe, and they frequently espouse views, sort of, if you take them as a group, that are sort of incoherent, that don't always match up to each other.
Is it?
I mean, yeah, and if you and you know you see the same thing to sort of to bring up another initiative that we talk about, you know, with the Republican spending cuts. I would like to think that Republicans are a little more serious about spending cuts than some of these other things we've talked about, that there will actually be some action there. But you know, I see calls to only bring back to bring spending down to 2008 levels, which seems, or 2007 levels maybe, which seems like a sort of odd place. It strikes me that like 1999 or 2000, adjusted levels make a lot more sense, especially since we were coming out of a time of balanced budgets at that point, and that's been a big focus of Republicans. They sort of, Republicans are saying on the one hand that Bush spent way too much. Let's go back to how much he was spending at the end of his presidency. I mean, like, you actually have a lot of Tea Partiers who, I think, way too late, but you do have them saying, yeah, Bush was a big spender and it was terrible. We're hoping to get past that, to change that with the folks they voted in this time. But there doesn't seem to be any interest in that. I mean, the Republicans have already backed down on their promise to cut $100 billion. Well, maybe it's more like $50 billion. We were going to, no earmarks except the earmarks we like, the whole thing. I mean, there's no, and then John Boehner totally refuses to name any specific cuts to anything, that he can't name a government program that he thinks we should do without. And I guess, I don't know. Like, it's incredibly frustrating to me. And we write about this all the time at Reason, that Republicans, not even remotely serious on any of this stuff, as a party, again, individuals accepted, but not remotely serious. And I don't, like, I sort of wonder, do Tea Partiers know? Do they care? How many times can it's like, I actually see Boehner getting called on this pretty frequently. Even by, to some extent, by conservatives, certainly by national media, certainly, like I said, certainly we do it all the time. Liberals make fun of him for it, understandably, for not, even being able to name a single pro. Surely you understand you're going to get this question. And he has, and clearly prepared to answer it by not answering it. That is, at this point, clearly a decided, considered strategy for whatever reason. I understand that there are sort of peril in answering specific programs, like, but you have to do that eventually, or you have to just sort of give up and say, yeah, we're not going to do any of this. One of the two.
I mean, I think there are a few things going on here. The first is that, it is actually genuinely hard to come up. Like, if you're saying we're going to cut $100 billion from the budget, if you're already from the start exempting military spending or any national security spending, it's actually very difficult to actually detail where you're cutting without offending everyone you represent, right? Like, you can do an across the board cut of discretionary spending or non-defense discretionary spending, a term I don't like, but it's useful here. You can do an across the board cut there, but then you have to explain to your constituents that, there won't be that much money for heating for old people this winter, and there won't be much money to help your kid go to college, and so on and so forth. The other issue is that I've never been convinced that the Republican Party as a party is terribly interested in cutting spending. It's always seemed to me, and looking back at like the last 30 years of Republican governance, that the big concern is cutting tax rates for higher income people. And if you can cut spending too, that's great, but better to cut these tax rates than spending. If given the choice, if you have to choose one, it seems that Republicans will always go for the cutting tax rates and leave the spending for later, than they will cut spending and then cut tax cuts if there is room for doing that as well.
I basically agree. I mean, Republic, look, I think that it's very important to let people keep their own money. I am in favor of dramatically lower taxes, and keeping tax rates lower, and simpler. On the other hand, what Republicans have always totally, totally failed to understand is that spending is taxation, that if you spend the money, you eventually have to pay for it somehow or another. And the way you do that, if you're the government, is by collecting money from the people through taxes.
And
Republicans have just sort of totally refused to accept this reality that spending requires that if you're going to spend it, you then have to have taxes to pay for it.
And the other side of that is that if you have a tax cut without reducing spending, then you are effectively spending. That like cutting taxes by like $500 billion,
right,
but then not cutting the budget by $500 billion is in its effect, it's a spending increase.
Right. I mean, it's passing it along to people who are, you know, to a younger generation who is not even involved in large part. I mean, because what you end up doing is you're delaying all of this.
I mean, that doesn't bother me too much, but you know.
But Republicans at least claim to be bothered by the generational effects of spending, and don't tend to think about them when it comes to taxes. And how their tax policy fits in with this. And it's incredibly frustrating. There are a few Republicans who often seem genuinely interested in some of the details of policy and in fixing some of this. But you saw even, something like Simpson-Bowles, which was in many ways a pretty good compromise, a compromise tilted somewhat, maybe not perfectly, maybe not to. It's certainly not my ideal, but it was. But there was a lot to like in it. Tilted to the priorities of making government smaller and having it spend less. You had, I believe, two of the four Republican members, not vote for it, and very little Republican interest in following through on any of the proposals or sort of figuring out ways to enact any of that. Again, because they've figured out what they're against. They have not figured out at all what they are for. And the lack of a coherent, forward-looking policy message that is plausible, that they are politically and that they are trying to build a base of political support for, I just don't know how they're going to, that wave has to crash at some point, and I don't know how they're going to continue to surf it.
I think they, I mean, to push back a little, I think they know what they're for, and again, that's lower tax rates for higher income people, and that sort of everything else is sort of, I mean, beyond that, they don't have much of an agenda, but like insofar that they do, that is it, and that is sort of the main agenda, and everything.
But I guess my point is, that's not an agenda that matches with all of the principles and all of the rhetoric. Like, even if you, I am not sure that I would quite phrase it like that. I would say that Republicans are genuinely interested in tax cuts for everyone all the time, whether they're high income or not. But beyond that, I agree that they've had trouble coming up with anything to focus on. And I think that will eventually become a real problem as they continue to pound issues like debt deficits and spending, and as they continue to say, okay, things like, well, this healthcare bill doesn't work. I'm with them. I agree. And it needs to be, then let's trail off, and I don't know, something else there. Let's just, they don't, they get to that point and they say it'll need to be replaced. We'll tell you what we're going to replace it with later. We'll hope you're not really paying attention. We'll assign it to some committees and forget about it. It's totally unconvincing. It's not just totally unconvincing. It is not a complete agenda, and it eventually has to fall apart. It's a wave. It's going to crash. I understand how and why they're surfing it now, but I don't know how long it lasts. And I like you, I'm sort of curious to see what the Tea Party reaction is to this. Whether the Tea Partiers sort of just get folded in to the Republican Party and say that, look, this is what you can do. Cutting taxes is good. Therefore, we will do it. Or whether there will be some sort of, whether they become disillusioned, and sort of give up on the political process. My understanding is a lot of Tea Partiers came from outside the political process. And I really don't know. I'm curious to see where the next four 8, 10 years take us in terms of this, you know, while the budget problem mounts, you know, and while and they're because they're really the Republicans are right in a sense that there really is a serious budget problem. On the other hand, Republicans totally uninterested, as far as I can tell, in doing anything particular and specific about it.
Do you want to go move on to the next topic?
To the fun part, to Batman.
To Batman. Yeah. So basically, Warner Brothers announced a few casting tidbits for the next Batman movie, The Dark Knight Rises, and Tom Hardy, who, if you've seen Inception, you might remember as the really dapper guy, is playing Bane, and Anne Hathaway is slated as Selina Kyle or Catwoman, for those who aren't that deep into Batman geekdom.
So probably most people have some idea who Catwoman is, even if that some idea is based on either Batman Returns or the original Bam Pow Whap Adam West serial.
Or maybe the, 2006, 2007 Halle Berry movie?
Oh, that's right. I totally forgot that existed.
For good reason. So
it was supposedly what I didn't actually see it. It was so universally panned as not even being good, bad, and it was directed by one of those artsy fartsy directors with one name, Pitoff or something.
Yeah.
Lord, I totally forgot about that one. But for folks who do not know who Bane is, he was the character who broke Batman's back in
right.
one of the big Batman stories from sometime in the mid late 90s.
It was like mid 90s, Batman Nightfall. I want to say like 94, 95.
It was right as I was quitting reading comic books as a teenager.
And I was 7 years old.
I would think I was in like middle school at that point and was like, okay, I'm too old for this. And of course now I read comic books all the time. Now that I'm, in my 20s. So I'm curious what you think of, do you have any reaction to that? Anne Hathaway strikes me as potentially a pretty good Catwoman. My guess is she'll play seductive and crazy, rather well.
Yeah,
against Christian Bale. I'm curious about what they're going to do with Bane, who's always been a sort of absurd and cartoony character. If you remember Batman and Robin, he showed up in like a hilarious, like poofy
right.
muscle suit, like a cheap Halloween suit.
I mean, so I don't know. Like there are elements of Bane that are actually pretty interesting. You know, in the at least comic canon, he is raised in a Mexican prison. He's like a you know, shockingly intelligent, like intellect, if not on the level of Bruce Wayne, then very close, who ends up, you know, in control of like some large swath of Mexican underworld and sees breaking Batman as like his new life's goal. He will destroy Batman. And he even discovers Batman's secret identity. He figures out that Batman is Bruce Wayne. But then that sort of cool concept is marred by the fact that he has a ridiculous getup even in the comics.
But it was the 90s. Everybody in comics had ridiculous.
It was
thank you, Rob Liefeld.
Yeah. So my guess. So I happen to give Chris Nolan a lot the benefit of the doubt here. I remember when Heath Ledger was cast as the Joker, and a lot of people were like, "Well, that's ridiculous. Heath Ledger right. is just some pretty boy." And as it turned out, Heath Ledger was fantastic as the Joker. So yeah. I am given that Chris Nolan has given us the two best Batman movies ever. I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt for his casting choices for the third. My guess is that for Bane, he will take some of the familiar elements, the intellect, the strength, probably the control of the underworld and ambition to destroy Batman, and then like wrap it around a different sort of character or a different, the details of that might be different, but the core of the character will probably be the same. I'm actually more interested to see what he does with Catwoman. Because, you know, I'm not a big fan of Catwoman as a character. I don't think she's terribly interesting.
Hasn't she become kind of a good guy in recent
yeah,
Batman lore?
Yeah. She's like an anti-hero, basically. Like,
Right.
some petty crime helps Batman out.
Right.
Not too bad. It's
So,
sort of like the Black Cat in Spider-Man.
right. So what's interesting to me about the Nolan Batman franchise, I totally agree that they're the best Batman movies, but I would actually go beyond that and say they're some of the best Batman stories, period,
No, agreed.
of the past 20 years. Not because they're particularly well plotted. They're only the both with both films, the problem is the scripts are only pretty good. David Goyer is not the best writer in many ways, but Nolan gets great stuff out of his actors anyway. He hires great actors who can deliver terrible dialogue really well. And he gets the tone right.
Right.
He seems to have like a really, really precise and great understanding of like the core of the Batman character and the Batman universe. And it is, in fact, in many ways, it's a more classic understanding than what's going on in the comic books these
Right.
days. For those who are not uber nerds, Grant Morrison, who is a sort of comic book author, a druggy, psychedelic, crazed, whatever, who's been a very popular comic book writer for about the past 20 years, took over the main Batman series, I believe, at the end of 2006, and has been sort of taking Batman through a whole bunch of interesting paces and cycles. He wrote a series called Batman R.I.P. Didn't actually kill Batman, but had him lost in
Time
time.
traveling Batman.
Yeah, due to some circumstances related to Darkseid, who's like the ultimate DC villain. We're getting way deep in the weeds here. I probably shouldn't. But what Grant Morrison has done most recently is he brought Batman back, and Batman has now turned Batman into a global franchise. Bruce Wayne made the announcement to the public at the end of an issue that came out in like December, within the last month or two. Announced to the public that he had been funding Batman all this time, and that now he was going to fund more Batman in more cities across the globe. And so you have this, like really sort of interesting modern revisionist, sort of, Pomo take on Batman, very much in keeping with what Morrison has done traditionally, but like really, really stretching the bounds of the character in a lot of ways. Within the comic books, and this is in the main Batman series. This is part of the primary Batman continuity, and part of the story that's been going since the 40s or whatever at Detective Comics when Batman was first first came into being. And so he here in the comic books, in the place where Batman originated, and in the place where in theory the fans should be most rabid and most uninterested in dealing with serious revision and serious experimentation, you have actually a whole lot of revisionism and a whole lot of experimentation with the character. Whereas in the movies, you have this actually fairly classic,
Right.
updated somewhat. He's dark in the way that people in the
Frank
heroes in the
Miller.
aughts, right? But even he's not even as revisionist as Frank Miller's Dark Knight was in Dark Knight
Right.
Returns.
I was going to say that, the Batman, Nolan's Batman bear really does bear the most similarity to, Bob Kane's original Batman, and in terms of attitude, in terms of tone. Like, I don't know for watchers, I don't know if they actually read the original Batman comics, but they're lighthearted at all. They're not grim, but they're not light, and they're very, it's very obvious that they're coming, that Batman's influence from noir, and other such genres.
Right, they're psychologically inflicted crime stories that have a superhero at the center. And that's what Nolan is doing. And Nolan, you can see his cinematic influences, guys like Kubrick. He's mentioned Blade Runner a whole bunch of times. And you can see the way that Blade Runner influenced the design of Gotham City in the first Batman, less so when he just sort of used Chicago as the stand-in in the second. But he's combined this icy and future, sort of retro-futuristic cinema these icy fu retro-futuristic cinematic influences on the one hand, with sort of the classic idea of Batman as sort of a lost soul, search who's out, who's fighting for his own humanity and not sure if it's still left in the movies. And it's been interesting to me that he succeeded so well. And in many ways, I kind of feel like he's given the comic books space to experiment, because he's created this, you know, the most pop, what is currently the most popular incarnation of Batman is the movies, and it's a very classic way of portraying the character.
I'll say the only thing that the other thing that sort of stands, I think, equal with Nolan's Batman's is the original run of Batman the Animated Series, which for the yes. I think before Nolan's Batman's, and I think you can still sort of contest as it can go either way, but at least before Nolan's Batman's, the animated series in my mind was sort of the definitive version of Batman.
Yes.
I mean, in fact, in my head, Batman is still Kevin Conroy.
Along those lines, the Batman video game, Arkham Asylum, which featured Kevin Conroy as the voice, is actually quite good. If you haven't played it, highly recommend it.
I haven't played it, but I've heard it's really great.
And it's Paul Dini who was involved, who was like one of the, I believe, the showrunner on Batman the Animated Series, wrote the script for the Arkham Asylum video game. The best description I heard of the game was that it is effectively a Batman simulator. The gameplay actually sort of really gives you the opportunity to do all the stuff that like that Batman does. And so it's interesting that, you know, it continues to fascinate me sort of how you have these, all these different versions of the character, floating out there. And how Nolan's classic interpretation of the character, which is, I think also, you know, I think the animated series is a really good touchstone, and he's clearly paid attention, watched and drawn a lot from that sort of a lot, especially with like the way the animated series had this sort of 40s vibe to it.
Yeah.
You know, with the Tommy guns and whatnot, and Nolan's pulled from all that and made this incredibly popular, classic version of the character. While at the same time, you've had all this, you know, interesting experimentation in the comic books. I don't know. I don't have any larger thought beyond that. Just it's an interesting contrast.
This is a good place to end, actually.
Indeed. Well, nice talking to you, sir.
Same. Hopefully, we'll do this again.
Indeed.
Alrighty.